And now,
the definition. Definition.
Oh my God, guys. Donald Trump did it again. He stranded his supporters again. This time, in Butler, Pennsylvania, he left thousands of supporters freezing in the cold, in the dark, because the shuttles that were supposed to take them back to their cars seemingly haven't showed up. That's what happened. And this is exactly what happened less than a week ago in Omaha, Nebraska, where again, Trump did one of his plane stop tours where he flies in his plane, he does a rally, everyone buses in to see him, and then they fly out, and he left his people there, his most loyal, ardent, dedicated supporters, the people that love Trump so much, they would come out during COVID to see him, knowing it's unsafe to do so, and left them there to suffer. And it's not funny. You might say, oh, these Trump supporters, they're so stupid, whatever. That's like, let's be real. People had to go to the hospital because of it. Some of the most vulnerable people, elderly folks that came out to see the president, had to go to the hospital because of his campaign and his own negligence. And you say, okay, awful. Yes, awful, humiliating, disgusting. Maybe it was a tragic accident. And less than a week later, in Butler, Pennsylvania, guys, it just happened again. I'm going to read you a tweet. This is from a CNN journalist who was on the scene as it was happening. This is DJ Judd. He says, Trump has finished and left, but there are thousands of supporters who have been let loose into the night with no sign of the shuttles they've been told will take them back to the parking. People are filling the street, blocking the road for ambulances and police. And as he notes, it's 41 degrees. So not quite technically freezing cold, but very close to it. You know, about 5 degrees above 0 Celsius. Absolutely unacceptable that Donald Trump would do this twice in under a week. You can no longer say it's a series of unfortunate events type accident. Trump is clearly negligent when it comes to the health and safety and dignity of Americans in general. Yes, we already knew that. But even of his most ardent supporters. These are people that love him, that want to see him, that will come out even though it's dangerous to see him. They'll do it cold, wet, dark, snowy, whatever. They'll do it. They'll come and see him. And you can disagree with those people. But, you know, they love this president. They do. And Trump sees that love they have for him. And Trump doesn't, you know, look at that and think about it honorably. He sees these people as pawns and as props to exploit for his political imagery. Because Trump and his campaign knows how dangerous it is to hold these rallies. And he doesn't care. He buses people out into a cold, dark, freezing fields in the middle of nowhere in some cases, because you got to park and then get bused to them to fill up a rally to make it look good. These people are literally, they're literally pawns and props for his political propaganda. He comes in on his luxury jet, talks for a few minutes saying nothing that matters, nothing that's actually going to improve the lives of working and middle class people or the lives of those people's children. And then he flies out on his luxury jet, as Joe Scarborough noted, probably with all the fast food and all the amenities he could ever want. And he leaves these regular working and middle class people to freeze in the cold, dark night. Again, this is a metaphor for Trumpism, for the Trump presidency and the Trump campaign. He governs on behalf of the 1% and maybe the top 5%, and usually, you know, maybe the top 0.1%, you know, the richest of the rich, but he needs the votes of so many regular people to become president and to stay president. And those folks, you can call them misguided, you can call them fools, you can call them people plagued with false consciousness, whatever. They love this president, and they came out to see him, and they got screwed again by him.
Good evening from Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm Kristen Welker of NBC News, and I welcome you to the final 2020 presidential debate.
You ready?
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
What's that all about? You're the big man, I think.
Come on. You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
You keep talking about all these things you're gonna do.
Yeah. You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
What's that all about? You're the big man, I think.
Come on. You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden. I beat all those other people because I disagreed with them.
So, as you know, it's a worldwide pandemic, and we're fighting it. We're fighting it hard. There is a spike. I was in the hospital. I had it. I got better. I'm immune. They gave me a therapeutic.
He gets out of the hospital, and he talks about, this is open. Don't worry.
COVID-19!
Learning to live with it. We're dying with it. People learning to die with it.
Come on. It's not my fault that it came here. It's China's fault. Look at China, how filthy it is. It's China's fault.
They will pay a price. It's all gonna be over soon.
Don't worry, maybe check bleach.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
What's that all about? You're the big man, I think.
Come on.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
You keep talking about all these things you're gonna do.
Yeah.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
What's that all about? You're the big man, I think.
Come on.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden. I beat all those other people because I disagreed with them. There's a reason why he's bringing up all this malarkey. Is talking about me taking money. I have not taken a single penny from any country. I have not taken a penny.
Number one, I don't make money from China. You do. I don't make money from Ukraine. You do. I don't make money from Russia. You do. You were getting a lot of money from Russia.
Not true.
He said the biggest problem we have is North Korea. We have a very good relationship and there's no war.
We had a good relationship with Hitler before he in fact invaded the rest of Europe.
Come on.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
What's that all about? You're the big man, I think.
Come on.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
You keep talking about all these things you're gonna do.
Yeah.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
What's that all about? You're the big man, I think.
Come on.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden. I beat all those other people because I disagreed with them.
I think I have great relationships with all people. I am the least racist person in this room. I can't even see the audience because it's so dark. But I don't care. I'm the least racist person in this room.
You know who I am. You know who he is. You know his character. You know my character. Abraham Lincoln here is one of the most racist. I am
who?
Joe Biden. And you said you're Abraham Lincoln.
Where did that? No, no.
You said,
I said not since Abraham Lincoln has anybody done what I've done for the black community.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
What's that all about? You're the big man, I think.
Come on.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
You keep talking about all these things you're gonna do.
Yeah.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden.
What's that all about? You're the big man, I think.
Come on.
You know who I am.
Who?
Joe Biden. I beat all those other people because I disagreed with them.
Well, you've mentioned the words White House three or four times now, so just as I talked to you about before we went on air, I don't want this, as tempting as it is, Morris, I don't want this to for the rest of our time, short time together, but I do, particularly from you, we need to have one question from Pukalo regarding the White House, and this is his question. Donald Trump was recently laughed at during his address to the United Nations. Many persons don't regard Trump as funny at all, but rather as a monstrous representation of later stages in the deterioration of USA culture. Do you have a similar view? You have mentioned in your web blog that everything Trumpy does is a blunder. Some regard him as by far the worst president that has ever existed in the U.S. Is this an accurate view? So let's give this about 5 minutes. Let's give this about 5 minutes.
Hello?
Yeah, so let's give this about 5 minutes, Mar. So is Donald Trump, what is Donald Trump's purpose for sitting in the White House? Let's just ask the question that way, I guess.
Well, I don't know if he particularly has a clear purpose in his own mind. It doesn't seem like it, but I think history has a purpose for him. And that's the crucial point here that I would make. You know, Hegel wrote about world historical individuals who represent the most poignant trends of their time. And it wouldn't matter if it was Trump. I mean, you know, he gives the example of Napoleon, and if it wasn't Napoleon, it would have been somebody else to do that job. Trump was assigned the job of history to dismantle the United States. Hegel is speaking through me now.
Okay.
I'm channeling Hegel. And his job is essentially to degrade and dismantle the country. That is to say, we are at the end of American civilization, and this is what we need. We need somebody who will basically take the final step. He's perfect for this. So although you can say, is he the worst president, from a Declinist point of view, he's the best.
Yeah.
He's the perfect choice. He's a vulgar boor. He's a fool. He's vicious. I mean, the number of adjectives one can go, that's just what we need. We need Trumpy. We need Kavanaugh. We need Bolton. We need Steve Bannon. We need Gina Haspel. This is the most disgusting collection of people that has ever been in government. That's what the times call for. And he's doing the United States a lot of damage, and that's what needs to happen. In the late Roman Empire, you know, the emperors were quite a collection. I mean, one was a child, one was 7 years old, which is about the emotional and intellectual level of Trump. There were a couple that were actual morons. They were idiots. And so this helped along the process of disintegration, obviously. And so we have the same thing with Mr. Trump. He's doing what he's supposed to be doing. And, you know, I mean, I think there are a lot of horrible things connected with having somebody like Kavanaugh on the bench. But the positive thing, from a Declinist point of view, is that it degrades the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court loses the prestige that would have. To have a buffoon like that, you know, as a justice of the Supreme Court, all these institutions are now degraded by people like this. And that's how a civilization or a nation becomes unraveled. And that's what's happening.
So on one level, it sounds like you're cheering on the decline and fall of the American Empire just to clean out the dead wood. That it's just got to the point where it's hopeless. You almost sound like you're agreeing with Steve Bannon that we need to burn the house down and rebuild it.
Yeah, of course, his vision of what would be rebuilt is very different from my own. But I do think that there's no point in delaying the process. If Hillary had won the election, Trump was right in the debates. If Hillary had won the election, it would have been more of Obama. That's all she had to offer.
Yeah.
Neoliberalism, globalization, the wealthy slowly get wealthier. That's all she had to offer, and that's the slow disintegration. What Trump offered was, he didn't realize it. He said he was going to save America. But what he was really offering was a rapid disintegration. And that's what he's delivering. That's what we're getting. My own feeling is, why wait? I mean, what is it we're waiting for? Just to die slowly on the vine? That doesn't strike me as a happy scenario.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Da 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 greetings. Welcome to the Class 4 Bedroom Podcast episode. Trump is America, ladies and gentlemen. Trump is America. You need to understand this, pound this into your head. Trump is America. Particularly, Trump is the elite in America. He is the most grotesque, most diabolical aspects of the elite, their collective mind state. That is who Trump is. I'm recording this in the very last moments of Halloween 2020. I don't know yet who has won the presidential election. But I watched another story about Trump stranding thousands of people who came out to see him late at night without shuttles. Well, not late at night, but at night without shuttles, or in the freezing cold without shuttles. And I couldn't help but to think to myself, you know, Trump gave these people the opportunity. Don't think I'm cold for this, but Trump gave these people the opportunity to come out and see him. But you know what else Trump did? He gave them the opportunity to get back home. Now, you may say, wait a minute. What do you mean he gave them the opportunity to get back home? Well, ladies and gentlemen, he gave them access to being able to get back home. Now, again, you might be saying to yourself, wait a minute, what are you talking about? He gave them access to get back home. What exactly are you talking about? I would hope you'd get it by now. See, Trump did exactly what the elite does, okay? The elite says, come out and applaud for me by going to work and working hard to try to be me. And that's, these people, all they want to be Trump. That's what it all comes down to. They see Trump as a manifestation of the American dream, which is funny. But that's the truth. I've literally had Trump supporters tell me this. But what the elite does, as they're saying, you know, go to work so you could be like me, is they don't tell you that it's a fantasy. You ain't never going to be them doing that. Not only are you never going to be them doing that, but you're going to work your life away. And at the end of the day, ladies and gentlemen, you're going to have more worries than they ever will. And they know this. But while you're working yourself into that position, they're going to give you the opportunity to do a lot of other things. Like, you know, have daycare. They want to give you access to daycare, you know. They want to give you the opportunity to have health care or access to health care. They want to give you the opportunity and access to a lot of things that's going to maybe slightly possibly improve your life as long as you have the money to pay for it. See, all of these people who got stranded out there, they had the opportunity to go home if they had the money. They had access to the road. Well, damn, that's a far away walk to have to walk home, isn't it? But did they have the transportation to get there? No, they didn't. Well, whose fault is that? That's theirs. They didn't have the transportation. They didn't have the money. That's their problem. And that's exactly the mind state of Trump. It's their problem, not his, which is the mind state of the wealthy. That's your problem. Sure, we don't want you having unions because, you know, then you might actually organize yourself and exercise your power against us, so we don't want you having unions. But hey, we still like you enough to give you opportunities and access to the things that we take for granted. That's who Trump is. And maybe it's about time that we recognize this. You want to understand why you're not seeing a bunch of rich people drop dead from this coronavirus? It's because while you and I, you know, the poor slubs who actually go to work and do the work of this nation, which they continuously say, oh, you're our heroes, but don't ask for too much money. Don't ask for anything else. You're our heroes, though. While you and I go and we slub our way through our day for pennies, they get to sit home. Or if they do happen to catch the coronavirus, now this is one thing Trump did do. Trump blew a lid off of the reality of what the wealthy are being given for the COVID. He did. He told everybody, look, they gave me this cocktail of antibiotics that even, I think it was CNN, it was either CNN or MSNBC had to admit, wasn't generally available to your average person. Trump spilled open the floodgates of the treatment that he was given to help him recover that most people wouldn't be given. Why? Because it costs millions of dollars. Why does it cost millions of dollars? Ladies and gentlemen, I have news for you about healthcare. The reason it costs millions of dollars is because the wealthy don't want you to have it. It's not the fact that it's limited, that it's scarce. It's just they don't want you to have it because you might live a good life. I mean, yes, Trump is a personification of the most grotesque images of who they are, of their collective psyche. But Donald Trump has never been acceptable to them. So Donald Trump can shat on them because they don't like him and he don't like them. So he's willing to spit on them. But I don't want you to lose sight of this, ladies and gentlemen. They don't like you. They give you access to all kinds of things. They give you the opportunity for all kinds of things. If I walk past a hospital and I'm sick, I actually have access to the hospital. I can walk into the hospital. There's a law that says I walk into the hospital, they have to treat me, but they only have to stabilize me, then they can shut me out the door. I have the opportunity to have health care in that manner. But guess what? That's not health care. Health care means that you get the care that you need until you are healthy. You get the care that you need until you are healthy. That's what health care means. It is not a plaything. People cannot live without health. I've had this argument with friends of mine who support Trump, who support the Republican nonsense about, oh, the horrors of socialized medicine. I'll say to them, you come at me with the Constitution and you say that it promises you life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, I can tell you something. Without life, you ain't got liberty and you ain't got no pursuit of happiness. You can't get it. And what is life? Life is wellness. Life is health. If you don't have your health, then you cannot have liberty. Then you cannot have a pursuit of happiness. Everybody sensibly knows this. How do I know everybody sensibly knows this? Because most people recognize that when grandma's getting a little bit up there, grandma can no longer do the things that she used to do. She may not be able to drive anymore, so you have to take away her keys. She may not be able to go to the store anymore by herself, so you may have to accompany her. Her liberty is restricted. Not in the sense that, you know, some tyrannical government is taking away her ability to do these things. No, her liberty is restricted by age. She's not able to do the same thing that she did before because she has aged to a point where maybe her body isn't able to do those things anymore. It's sad, but it's the truth. When you hit a certain age, and I was told this by somebody older, when you hit a certain age, you stop worrying about the material so much. I mean, granted, the wealthy don't seem to ever do that. But you hit a certain age and you stop worrying about the material so much. You start worrying about the relationships around you because those things are what matter. Those are the things that fill you with joy. So without life, there is no liberty and there is no pursuit of happiness. On that note, for the wealthy and for Trump, the pursuit of happiness is summed up as more money. More money, more control, more power. More money, more control, more power. Greed is what their pursuit of happiness seeks. For us, we are told by our pastors, you know, by our religious folk, who the wealthy never listen to, by the way, that greed is bad. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, trust me when I tell you, I ain't telling you that greed is good. Greed is bad. But then when some of us sensible people start saying, well, then why don't we develop a system that, you know, makes sure that greed is very difficult to obtain? Well, whoa, we're told by the wealthy who are greedy and who then tell us to listen to the pastors that, whoa, you don't want to do that because that's going to stop human ingenuity. You know, it was greed, that pursuit of greed that helped us grow our society, that helped us grow our civilization, that made us the great country that we are. If we didn't have greed, ladies and gentlemen, that's what we're told. If we didn't have greed, then we would not be where we are as a society. I literally had this conversation with somebody the other day. They were saying to me that without competition, we would not have what we have today. And I had to say to them, look, man, we may not have what we have today, but who's not to say that we wouldn't have anything better? Who's not to say it? Instead of worrying about competition, what if we collaborated? Maybe we'd be 1,000 years farther with this idea of technology right now. Technology that actually fused with nature and didn't injure it. They were shocked to hear me say that. I said to him, you know, former military guy, nice guy, by the way, really nice guy. I said, you know, look, on we think of corporations, for instance, as competitive entities. I think of corporations as cooperative entities. The problem is the balance of power within them have been structured to prevent cooperation. It could be even a collaborative entity, but it's not. He was shocked by that because he had never thought about that. I bet you Donald Trump's never thought about it either. Because for most wealthy people, corporations are just a way to extract money from people and from society and from communities and from families. I've heard wealthy people on like CNN and Fox Business and, you know, CNBC and Bloomberg say, this notion that we don't like, you know, poor people, that we don't like people, is just overblown. That's just some leftist radical nonsense. And, you know, if I was in front of those people, I'd say your actions speak louder than your words. Your actions speak louder than your words. When you are paying politicians to prevent what you call socialized medicine from coming into the United States because you won't be able to profit off of it, and then simultaneously you are putting money into politicians' pockets to prevent us from regulating this crappy healthcare system that you help to maintain just because it will stop you from gouging people when you are seeking to make a profit. You tell me what that looks like. You tell me how I am supposed to interpret that, because I guarantee, that's what I tell them, how you're looking at me right now is that I don't like you because of how I'm talking. Well, your actions tell me you don't like me. This now circles back to Trump at his rally. This circles back to Trump at his rally. Think about it, ladies and gentlemen. Two times now he's pulled people out into some decently cold weather. Now, the one out west was significantly cold. The one in Pennsylvania was, I believe, 41 degrees. He pulled them out into that weather and did not have the decency to ensure that buses were there to take them home. I couldn't paint a more brilliant metaphor for how the elite during this pandemic has treated the American people if I tried. If I tried. The elite during this pandemic have gone home. They have been safe in either the homes that they have been owning, or many of them are leaving the cities and moving to various places throughout the country because they can't leave. They can't go to other countries. Other countries won't take them. We've, in the area that I am living in, we have seen the housing market boom because families from downstate are moving up here to buy houses because we have some very affluent communities in this area. So they're home. They're safe. They have their money. They can go to the store and buy all the food that they want. At the same time, the most wealthy among them are paying politicians to make sure that you can't. To make sure that if you get a little drop of money from the government, they want to make sure that it is the minimalist of drops, while they themselves are lobbying actively for big companies to get millions. And in some cases, it may end up being billions and tens of billions of dollars of help from either the government directly, House of Representatives, or the Federal Reserve. I got to tell you, family, the people in other countries are shocked by what's happening here. They see that the government has completely abdicated its job, its responsibility to its citizens. And it's done so. They understand why. And you better start understanding why. To my conservative brothers and sisters, you better start recognizing that you have been shilling for corporations, and those corporations are not shilling for you. They're not, and they won't. They have one thing in their mind and one thing only. They want your money. They want your money. They do not care how low it throws you, but they want your money. You know how I know that they don't care? Because I'm black. I look at what they've done to my communities, where we live, en masse. They want our money, but they won't put jobs there. And don't give me this garbage about, oh, it's not safe. If the police wanted someplace to be safe, they'd make it safe. You know how I know? Because white communities are safe. They won't put jobs there, but they'll sure extract hundreds of billions of dollars out of black communities quickly. And now what they've been doing to us, they will now do to you. The racism that Trump spews, that he supports, understand, that comes with a distinct hatred of white trash. That's what all of you've never understood. I told a friend of mine this earlier this year before the pandemic started. I told him the problem with Trump that he'll never get through his mind is that you keep thinking, he keeps thinking that it's about that it's about him, that Trump is looking out for him, my white friend. And I said, nah, Trump is a racist. You can tell me all you want that he isn't. He has a mile-long record telling me otherwise. He's a racist. His father was, and he learned it right from him. He was in his 30s when he had to start dealing with affirmative action and fair housing and stuff, and he flaunted it at, he sidestepped it at every chance he got. The man's a racist. He's a racist. He doesn't like black people unless he can get something from them. But the difference between my knowing that and what you think about his thinking on race is I also know that he can't stand you. He also hates poor white trash. And you are poor white trash to him. Just like all of these wealthy people, Mark Zuckerberg, Bezos, we are all dispensable for them. We're human resources to them. We ain't even human. We're like fleshed robots to them. That's where their minds are at. They're so brilliantly perfect at solving solutions that don't need to be solved, mainly because those solutions mean that they get more money, so breaking laws half the time, or paying people to write new ones. They're so perfect at doing that, that they're also perfect at fooling you as to why they're doing it. Donald Trump is a personification of the mentality of these people. And even though, yes, he may not understand what Zuckerberg does, he may not understand what Bezos does, and he may wish that he was as competent as them. At the end of the day, when Bezos has a child, when Zuckerberg has a child and they grow up and they're able to hit the world, Donald Trump will look more and more and more and more like the mentality that feeds those kids. He is a personification, and it's something we are going to have to deal with. Because at the end of the day, when we really, truthfully think about where this country is going to be headed, ladies and gentlemen, Donald Trump still has long life in this country. And the mentality that he personifies, that he emerged from, that still also has a very long life in this country. Unless we choose to dismantle it, and we are going to have to choose to do so. We are going to have to figure out in the coming 2 years, what this society is going to look like after COVID. Because it's unlikely that we're going to not be dealing with it, or that it's unlikely that we're not going to be dealing with it for less than 2 years. If we're lucky, it'll be 2022 that COVID is done. But we are going to have to make the choice. I recently saw a book, actually. I didn't pick it up yet. But the author was talking about, I just read through the description of the book. The author was talking about how COVID-19 is a crisis that is revealing to the masses of people the crises that already existed in society. And we are going to have to make strong decisions, very poignant decisions, on what we are going to do about these crises once this crisis is taken care of. Because this crisis is bringing to the surface other crises. And it is going to deform this country. Very much so, like Trump emerging. Everyone thinks that Trump deformed the society. Trump didn't deform the society. It is the deformed society that vomited up Trump, just like Chris Hedges says. It is the crises within the society that vomited up Trump. Now, one crisis that Chris Hedges doesn't talk about, which I really think spurred the creation of Trump is the fact that the demographics of this country is about to change. And white people, for the first time in their life, had to deal with it. Had to deal with the fact that the demographics in this country is going to change. With the election of Barack Obama, they had to finally deal with the fact that they were not the majority anymore. And that this meant not only that they were going to lose control of this country, but that ultimately they were going to lose control of the planet. Donald Trump was the last great white hope. He was the last great white hope. The problem is, because the white psyche always moves towards authoritarianism before finally it is forced to deal with its problems, it didn't recognize, or maybe it did, that Donald Trump personified so much of the problems, the schizophrenia, the psychopathy, the narcissism within their own society. And again, maybe they did recognize it. Maybe they did. But either way, they still elected him. And ultimately, they will be better off because maybe they did. I mean, honestly, when I look at Hillary Clinton sometimes, I think Hillary Clinton represents a portion of this society's psyche, which is barely ever discussed, which is the hardened, deformed, masculine mimicking femininity that has been, that was from the start of this country, excised from the spiritual body of this war, of this nation. Femininity was looked at as weakness, delicate, too irrational to be allowed to control any levers of power, even in the spiritual realm. This society has never embraced the femininity qualities or even the feminine qualities that is necessary to keep a country, a nation, a culture, a society balanced. And Hillary Clinton represents all of the negativity of, or at least her public face represents all of the negativity that femininity had to project in order to move in a world, a nation, should I say, that was created for men. Remember James Brown, this is a man's world. Yes, it may be a man's world. But what destructive tendencies had to be unleashed to make it that way? So who knows? Hillary Clinton may have not been a better president. And even though everyone keeps saying, oh, she would have been much, much better, she would have definitely been more capable. But that deformity, which brought us Donald Trump, and may have even brought us Barack Obama to some extent, the perfect black man that everybody could like, had to be conservative. The perfect black man that everyone could like, all white people, you know, suddenly they wanted their daughters to marry somebody like Barack Obama. He had to be conservative. He had to be a smooth talker, a smooth operator. He had to be somebody who you wanted to bring home, who put the concerns of those who he was trying to win over first. which for a black man, if you're trying to win over anybody, it ain't other black people, it's white folks. So the crises probably gave us Barack Obama too. But in any sense, Barack Obama followed by Donald Trump revealed the demographic shock, I believe, that hit the minds of white people, and they responded in kind. I know it's not popular among progressives to admit this. It's not popular among progressives to talk about this, but it is something that I believe. You know, I was reading a lot of newspapers during 2015, particularly the latter part of 2015 when Trump first got into the race. And throughout 2016, I was reading a lot of newspapers. And the one thing that they used to talk about a lot during that time period was the demographic change. They were preparing people for it. But as the summer of 2016 rolled through, those articles, which were very abundant in the latter part of 2015 and the early part of 2016, those articles disappeared. And I haven't seen as many of them over the last 4 years as it seems that I saw then. That demographic change, actually, I can't say that. I've seen quite a bit of them. But that call to see yourself as a natural minority, which white people are a natural minority on the planet, is not something that white people have been taught to deal with. They've always been taught to see themselves as a majority, as a powerful majority, as superior to other people. And one thing that I think Barack Obama proved, whether I like his policies or not, is that Barack Obama was capable. And if Barack Obama was that capable with to quote a friend of mine back in like 2010, if he was that capable in being half black, what does it mean for black people? You know, suddenly white folks had the same shock to their system that they had to deal with back after the Civil War. They had told themselves for a long time that black people were inferior, they were incapable of building society, they were incapable of holding together communities, they were incapable of being government officials or being governors, they were incapable of being engineers and inventors and the like, even though black people had been doing that for quite some time and white people had been profiting off of it, but they told themselves that. And within a few years after the Civil War, black people were doing all those things and more. And white people couldn't handle it. And Jim Crow came in very quickly. I believe that is what happened this time. And again, I give credit where credit is due. This was not something that I sought out to see. It was something that I learned by talking and listening to other white people and by just, you know, observing. But this crisis is going to go on for some time because we have to face the fact that, one, the contradictions in the society have gotten to a point where they threaten to ruin the society. And two, this demographic change cannot be averted or avoided. It's coming. And white people know it's coming. Years ago, I was working at a place, and there was this young lady, and she was young. I was just about 30 at the time. And she was giving me some strong attitude. She was about 18 years old. And so one day, you know, I walked up to her and, you know, said, "Hey, how's it going?" And, you know, she said, "Okay," and, you know, in a decent way. And I said, "Listen, You know, I notice you've been kind of at me about a few things. And I just wanted to ask you why. What did I do? You know, can we talk about this? And, you know, she kind of sheepishly kind of, you know, averted my eyes and said, you know, you didn't do anything. And I was like, well, then what is the problem? I mean, seriously, if I did something, let me know. And, you know, she wouldn't tell me then, but later on we talked, and she told me that her grandfather had been telling her to watch out for black men all his life. Because, you know, we were dangerous, we were this, we were that, we were this, we were that. And I kind of laughed at her, you know. I go, seriously, you're in a lit place with a lot of people. How dangerous can I be? How dangerous can I be? And she kind of, you know, kind of tilted her head up a little bit and said, you know, you're right. And I'm going, seriously, do you think I got this job to come in and assault somebody who I don't even know, who's done nothing to me, just so I can get fired for what, animal instinct or something? And I laughed at her, and she kind of looked at me. She's like, yeah, you know, that's kind of true. And I was like, so what's the problem? And she's like, I don't know. So she went home, came back the next day, and she was fine. And we became friends. I actually talked her into going to college some weeks later. I tell you this story, ladies and gentlemen, not because it's like, you know, white people can be rehabilitated, black people need to try to rehabilitate white people, but this idea, which, by the way, I know exactly why her grandfather told her to be careful for black men. Same thing that a lot of white folks have told their, particularly daughters, not necessarily their boys, but their daughters, for the longest time. It's that idea of their daughter having a black baby or a non-white baby. And it's this idea of this demographic change is messing with white people's minds. And we are not talking about it. Donald Trump knows that this demographic change is happening. This is why he's doing a lot of the things that he's doing when it comes to immigration. Now, this is where he's flouting what the wealthy would prefer. Because what the wealthy would prefer is to have all of these migrants from South America come up here, pay them a lot less to drive down the cost of labor so that then they can make more money and pay you less and you will get poorer. That's what they prefer to happen. Donald Trump is flouting that. That's, you know, that's his having to do with his psychology when it comes to them not liking him and him not liking them. But he's flouting him on that. That stated, the demographic change can't be halted. It won't be halted. And it's time that we recognize this. It's time we recognize this. So, though I only intended this to be short, I guess this is going to be a standalone episode here. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. You know how much I like hearing from you guys. I hope you are voting. I hope you are going out and enjoying the long lines if you are going out in person. And hopefully we will know who is president by the time I produce another episode. If not, which I guess I should add here. I guess I should definitely add here that I was listening to Nicole Sandler, and she was talking to a man who was on the ground, I guess, in the year 2000 in Florida. And, you know, just really quickly, the year 2000 was a very interesting year for me. I graduated from high school one. But during the time of the Florida debacle, a couple of things happened. One, my mother's adopted grandfather died. So Now, for those of you who don't know, because I don't really talk about it too much, but both of my parents died when I was a teenager. So they both died before I graduated from high school. So my mother's adopted grandfather died, and I was actually, I'd gone to her adopted grandmother's house to, to help out, and then ultimately went to the funeral, things like that. I can still remember coming home, which at that time, my family, my siblings and I were living in a house, but we were in the process of moving, basically. We were all kind of scattering, going our separate ways. The family was breaking up. But I can still remember. I can still remember election night, 2000. I was downstairs cooking dinner. I was the only one home. And I literally expected Al Gore to win. And when they took Florida back, my mouth dropped open. And I was like, oh my God, what is going on? And then watching the recount and everything unfold, it was surreal. And when Bush was finally declared the winner, I was numb. I felt like I had been robbed of something. Now, I didn't vote that year, but I felt distinctly like I had been robbed of something, like Bush should have never been president. And truthfully, I refused for the longest time to call him president until September 11th. Until September 11th. And then I was like, well, all right, bring it all together because of the country, blah, blah, blah. And the sound of the crowd in my ear. I am hoping we do not go through anything like 2000. I'm hoping we don't. Again, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I'm your brother, Vladimir Deese. See you on the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick.